Well, I worry about you guys sometimes, how much the weather impacts you. I've noticed when it rains as much as we need it, it seems like you guys are just a little more lethargic compared to when the sun's out. So if I catch you sleeping, like, we're all going to get up and do calisthenics. Are we clear? Okay. This morning, we're going to begin a new sermon series, something that has been on my heart and God's been working on me in my life for a while. And we're going to spend the next 3 weeks looking at it because we're going to begin a new series. And I'm worried some of you are lethargic because of the rain. We'll begin with a story because everybody likes a good story. The year was 1936, and our nation was struggling with economic depression, bank failures, and record summer temperatures. In a small, dusty town in southeastern Oklahoma, where the locals were experiencing the worst drought on record, my grandfather, a rancher, was dying of cancer. The cancer was eating away the flesh from the side of his face. The pain was so acute that his neighbors took turns sitting up with him at night. At times near the end, the men had to physically hold him to the bed. My grandfather owned one of the largest ranches in the county and was known for his generosity in helping others in need. Years after his death, we found a trunk in the attic of his ranch house, filled with IOUs from widows and men out of work. My grandfather, Bob Hall, had loaned money or cow to provide milk for their kids. But by the time he was ravaged with cancer, he had lost just about everything. My grandmother later recounted the last time he got out of bed. Bankers had come to foreclose on the last few head of livestock. My grandfather got up, put on his hat, as was his way, walked outside into the large front porch and into the yard. As the men on horseback drove the last herd of cattle through the corrals onto the dusty road and then westward until they were out of sight, he took off his hat, waved it weakly above his head, and let out a yelp. He then walked back into the house where he died a few weeks later. My father, 17 years old and a freshman in college at the time, left school to return to the ranch. There's no livestock left, and the family owed substantial taxes on the land. Everyone said, there's no way those boys will be able to hold on to the ranch. Dad and his two brothers went to every bank in the neighboring town of McAllister looking for a loan. Each time they asked, they got the same answer. We'd like to help you, boys, but your deal just isn't bankable. After they had exhausted all the banks in McAllister, they headed north and west across the South Canadian River to a bank in a little town of Holdenville. They got the same story, but as they were leaving, the banker said, if you could find someone to co-sign the note, I might be able to make a deal work. As a last gasp, they went to an adjoining neighbor, a lifelong family friend by the name of Buzz Newton, who was known to have money, but also to be a bit miserly. He used a piece of baling wire for a belt, had toes sticking out of his worn-out shoes, and had holes in his old shirts and pants. One lens of his wire-rimmed glasses was cracked. The other one was shattered. Buzz attended church about four times a year. When the offering plate was passed around, he'd dig down into his pocket for what seemed like an eternity, then pull out a nickel and put it in the collection plate. Shame on him. When the three brothers asked Buzz if he would co-sign the note, he replied, I always thought so much of your dad. He was the most generous man I've ever known. Yes, I will co-sign the note. On February 9th, 1937, the banknote was signed. The boys received $228 to buy livestock, seed for a crop, and implements. They had a good harvest that fall, paid off the note, and made sufficient payment on the taxes to keep the ranch. My father lived on and worked the ranch the rest of his life. It's where me and my sisters were born and grew up. It was the site of my youngest daughter's wedding and remains a family treasure today. That banknote, co-signed by Buzz Newton, is framed and hangs on the living room wall of the old stone ranch house as a reminder of the value of one single committed relationship. He says, most of us have family histories replete with similar stories. And a common thread in many of them is a key relationship that delivered us from difficulty and despair. For all of grandfather's accumulated assets, skills, and grit, it was a relationship that kept the ranch from being lost. Today, The unprecedented unraveling of these relationships is destroying us. At home, at work, in politics, and in faith, accumulating and compounding loss has collectively retarded our growth and development and injured us in ways both known and repressed. It's hard to miss the fact that pieces of our relationship infrastructure, family, friends, community, organizations, politics, churches, crumbling. We cannot build better lives or a stronger society on deteriorating relationships. It's the introduction to a book entitled This Land of Strangers. It's written by Robert Hall, and in this book, he goes on to describe what he calls our present-day relationship crisis. It's a crisis where we don't have the sort of relationships we used to. In fact, today, the average person has fewer relationships than in generations gone by. The ones that we do have, on objective scales, are of a lower quality. They're just not as good as they used to be, and their tenure is shorter. That is, they don't last as long. We're dealing with a relationship crisis. And what he does in the book is he tracks that crisis across four domains: in the home, between family members and friends, in the workplace, the relationships between employers, employees, between corporations and investors, between companies and consumers. He tracks it in the domain of politics and in the domain of religion. And not only does he track the actual changes, but he also counts the cost along the way. It's a book about what we lose when we lose relational connectedness. Here are just some of the stats, figures he offers. At home, in the United States, we lead the world in fatherless homes. That's not a good stat to be leading in, by the way. Tonight, 40% of all children will go to bed without a residential father within reach. Pay attention to the language. I didn't say biological father. I said residential father. 40%. 63% of children in the United States live without both biological parents in the home. Another stat in which we lead the Western world. There's actually an economic impact to all of this, of course. David Brooks writes in the New York Times, "If you're a middle-class woman, financially speaking, you have more to fear from divorce than from outsourcing. If you have a daughter, you're right to worry more about her having a child before marriage than her being a victim of globalization. This country's prosperity is threatened more by homes where no one reads to the children than it is by big pharmaceutical companies." Simple facts. Divorce and childbearing outside of wedlock significantly increase the likelihood of a child being raised in poverty. Broken relationships are a significant contributing factor to poverty. The sort of problem you can't throw money at. It's not about the dollars and cents. That's the consequence. It's about the relationship. The decline is not just in our families, but with our friends. The American Sociological Review, it's a journal, did a study. The number of people who report that they have no one in their life to discuss significant issues with, they just have nobody to talk to. That number tripled over the last 20 years. The decline in the number, the depth, and the tenure of our relationships has incidentally coincided with the rise of household pets, suggesting they're being used as surrogate relationships. We have fewer and fewer people that we're connected to, and so we go out and get a dog. It's true in the workplace as well. In the book, he cites stats to demonstrate our continuing distrust of corporations and our employers. The distrust has led to record turnover as the employer-employee relationship continues to erode. One incredible example of this is when David Brandon became the CEO of Domino's. When he took over, he was shocked to discover that the company had a turnover rate of 158% annually. 158%. And that's astounding when you discover that it costs the company $2,500 every time an employee quit and they had to hire somebody new, and $20,000 every time a manager quit and you have to hire somebody new. What they discovered is that their turnover costs were exceeding their profits because there's a problem with broken relationships. He has a whole chapter on the increase in conflict in politics. I don't think we need to belabor the point here. We're all well aware of that. But what is surprising is it's not just inter-party conflict. It's not just Republicans fighting Democrats. It's not just the right-left divide. It's inter-party conflict. What was interesting was a quote, comments made about Hillary Clinton during her presidential campaign. It's the sort of stuff I would never personally say, no matter what my political persuasion was, and it's the sort of quote, well, I can't share it with you. It wouldn't be appropriate to read from a pulpit in church. What was shocking was that these were comments made by her own party members in what we would probably consider a rather liberal publication. And it's religious. Religious people in our country, statistically speaking, increasingly feel our right to practice our religion, express our beliefs are being infringed upon. At the same time, there's an increasing segment of our population who does not believe, who perceive conservative politicians as trying to legislate their beliefs and values upon the nation. So we have a deep division between those who believe and those who don't believe, but the division goes even further. There's a division between different faiths. Of note, the Christian-Muslim divide. Westerners still perceive Muslims as fanatical, violent, lacking tolerance, while Muslims see Westerners as selfish, immoral, and greedy, as well as violent and fanatical. But it's not just interfaith conflict, it's interfaith conflict, the division of faith within the Christian church. Remember the Protestants and the Catholics, the violence in Ireland that was not too long ago, which was just the perpetuation of hundreds of years of violence in the Christian church. Many churches are being ripped apart because of ideological issues. It is almost certain that this summer the United Methodist Church will be divided into at least two different denominations. There's lots of broken relationships all over the place. It's not just divisions over what we believe, but the impact of how we've been doing church. Martin Marty says the hugely successful church growth movement has undermined the church's oldest purpose, that of building community. Churches were once built around a geographic community. Now they're constructed around similar lifestyles. And we're finding ourselves less and less connected. Theologian Peter Gomez summarizes all of this when he says, we have just enough religion to know how to hate, but not enough to know how to love. We live in a time of broken and fractured relationships. That's almost a truth. I basically don't need to say it. You know it. And I think all of us have experienced the attendant loneliness, have we not? You know it if you slow down enough to pay attention to it. For my generation, it's the loneliness of having 500 friends on Facebook, but nobody to spend Friday night with. Hundreds of friends on a social network platform, but nobody who really knows us or hears us or shows up in our life. Do you know the loneliness of wishing you had somebody to spend Friday night with, but settling for Netflix? Because there's nobody there to get together with. There's a new sort of loneliness. We describe it now as being alone together. Have you had this experience? You go into a room, and maybe it's a room full of people you know, or even it's a group of friends you would identify as friends, and even though you're together, you still feel inside something of a disconnect. Maybe you don't know what to name it, but there's something not quite right. You see it when friends go out for a meal. They're gathered around a table, but what are they doing? They're alone together. Have you experienced this? You might be one of the people this morning who, if you were being really honest, would say, you know what? I don't know who I would talk to if I had a significant issue in my life. Maybe you're one of these people who knows the pain of being alone and feeling alone in church. In the very place where we say we're supposed to be connected together because we have a spiritual connection, because we all gather under the name of Christ, and yet sometimes the pew can be a very lonely place. You may be the sort of person sitting here this morning wondering, if I wasn't here, would anybody care? Would they notice? And we might be tempted to think, well, come on, Pastor, this is a tiny little church. We're not a mega church. There's no strangers here. You would be shocked if you could all hear the conversations that as a pastor I get to hear. You would be shocked if you could hear and see how many people in this community of faith who self-identify as a regular attender, a regular member. I'm at the church. I'm engaged in the church activities. This is my church home. I'm a regular. But they do not know all the other people who also self-identify as regulars. That there are other people in this church who show up just about every Sunday. They come to the events. They don't know each other. And you say, surely not. I'm just telling you it's the case. We live in a time of broken relationships, and what we deal with is the attendant loneliness that I think plagues each and every one of us on some level. And especially because this is the church, this can't be the new normal. Now, when I say that, we're all like, yes, of course, this can't be the new normal. And I think our instinct is to then lean into those sorts of things that we would believe would diminish loneliness. And so we say, well, maybe what we need is more small groups. And you'll hear me say things like that because I'm a huge proponent of small groups. Small groups have this incredible connective power to bring lives together. That's why you'll hear me push and talk about discipleship bands. We get together to confess sin, to talk about our spiritual lives, but you know what people talk about? They rarely ever discuss the confession that they're doing together. What they talk about is the connection that they have with one another. I'm a big believer in small groups. And maybe our instinct is to say, well, then we need to get more engaged in our community. Maybe we need to not just do small groups in church, but also get more involved in civic organizations. And we need to practice hospitality, yes? Maybe we just need to throw a party. Maybe we need to invite people into our home, have them over for a meal, take somebody out for lunch. You've got to reach out. We need to create more connections because we have this loneliness problem, right? And these are all good things. But they must not be the first thing. If in our loneliness, our first move is to turn outward and seek others, what we will discover is that it's self-defeating. That what we've actually done inadvertently is undermined our own aim. If we're going to address the loneliness that all of us feel, the first move is not to turn outward, but to turn inward. And for most of us in this room, that turn inside will be very uncomfortable. Because I would dare say that most of us in this room, we have not been alone with ourselves in a very long time. Let me be clear about the sort of aloneness that I mean. I mean without your phone, without the internet, without a screen, without noise in the background, no radio, no podcast, not even a book, as wonderful as they are. Just alone in the silence. Long enough for all the racing thoughts to kind of run their course till you get to just nothing. But still silence. Where you begin to hear the divine whisper. The reason most of us do not go there is because it is in the silence that we are met with our pain. It's in the stillness that the pain of loneliness rears its ugly head. And we live in a time where you don't have to deal with your pain if you don't want to, because at your very fingertips are unending distractions and noise. But because we have avoided our pain so long, there is a part of our interior self who is a stranger to us. We do not know it because we've never been quiet long enough. We've never been willing to sit down in the pain. But hear me, church. The sitting in the pain of our loneliness is essential. It is the vital first step in its conversion. If you're really going to deal with the loneliness that plagues every human being, you don't deal with it by running to other people. Henry Nouwen tells us that we have never lived in a time where we have a greater degree of self-awareness of our absolute singularity, of our absolute aloneness. And yet I would suggest we've lived in a time where we really have no clue what to do about it. He says that our loneliness is like a chasm inside of our heart. The problem is, it doesn't matter how many people you throw in the hole, you never quite fill it up. And so if our first move is to always run to the other before addressing the self, we never actually get to the place where the loneliness is healed. If we want to deal with the loneliness, it has to be converted into something else. Our loneliness must be converted into solitude. Richard Foster says it this way: loneliness is inner emptiness, solitude is inner fullness. Solitude is the fullness that comes when we get alone with nothing but God. No list of asks, no agenda. No distractions, just me and God. Because when we can get to that place and we do have to go by the valley of the pain of our loneliness, what we discover is that there is a grace and a power in God that will begin to convert what feels like a desert in us into a garden. Our problem is that we do not know that. Our problem is that we're caught in self-defeating cycles where we think the solution for our loneliness is found in other people. I wonder how many marriages were entered into because we believed that by entering into the union, our loneliness would be taken away. We'd now have an other who would complement us. What we did not know was that we came to this significant other with a need they could not possibly hope to fill. The chasm was too deep. But we brought the need, and then we discovered that they couldn't give us what we wanted. And, well, then usually one of two things happen. One, we disengage and we go looking for another relationship. We say, well, I just must have picked the wrong person, but if I could find the right person, then they would fill me up. Then I wouldn't be lonely anymore. Or we stay in the marriage. We're just alone together. I suspect on some level all of us know some taste of that loneliness. You're sharing your bed with somebody, but you're still alone. It happens in friendships. We think our friends can fill up our needs. They can't. They cannot. And so one of two things happen. Either we disengage and say, well, these are lousy friends. I'm going to go find better ones. Or they disengage because what we've come to them with is a neediness that they know they can't take care of. And they, look, man, you're too needy. I can't give you what you're looking for. So they disengage. Either way, when we seek that fullness for our heart outside of ourselves first, it's the cycle. We always end up more lonely, more disconnected. And I wonder how often this happens in church. This is the body of Christ. We say, do we not, that the church is his incarnation or the body. And so we might think, right, if we have a spiritual need, if what we need is God, this would be a really good place to find him, right? And so we go to the community called by his name, thinking that in that place we will find what it is our heart longs for. And of course we say that we find Christ here, but we make a very subtle mistake, very subtle. It is the difference between seeking God in community and expecting the community to be God for us. Yes, the church is his incarnation. And we make him present in the world, but the church cannot be his infilling. Let me say it a different way. Until I know Christ in me, I will not be able to perceive Christ in you and in the space in between. I believe if we're going to become the solution to the world's problems, and if one of the problems we're facing today is a relationship crisis, if Robert Hall's right, if the problem underneath all of the other problems is that we have a series of broken relationships, then as Christians, we have to get this solitude thing right. understand there's a reciprocal relationship between solitude and community. And to the extent that you neglect one, the other will be diminished. If you do not attend to solitude, that place where you go and you're alone with God, and your needs are met first in Him, and the hole in you is filled, you will not do well in community. You'll come to community with a need that the community cannot provide the solution for, and you will do damage to the community because you yourself are not whole. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in his book Life Together, says it this way: let him who cannot be alone beware of community. And let him who is not in community beware of being alone. Each by itself has profound perils and pitfalls. One who wants fellowship without solitude plunges into the void of words and feelings, and the one who seeks solitude without fellowship perishes in the abyss of vanity, self-infatuation, and despair. We have to have both. I really believe that the solution to the deep pain we feel when we're not numbing ourselves with distraction and entertainment, that pain of loneliness that I really do believe every person in this room has experienced on some level, I really believe the solution to that is not running to small groups. It is running first to Christ. Because in that solitude where we're made whole, we are prepared for community. Well, what do we do with that? And I know that can seem impossible, yes? When you think about your life, do you see space in it for lots of solitude and silence without distraction? Well, I'll tell you, when I look at my life, I don't. I say, well, how in the world am I supposed to do that? Don't you understand what sort of life I have, Pastor? It's busy. I've got young kids. I've got 1,000 things to do. I've got responsibilities. I've got a very full schedule. And at the end of the day, I'm just wiped. And I'm hoping to unwind, not have to think about anything, go to bed, and then I get up and I do it again. I think the solution for our life, one way or the other, always, is to walk in the way of Jesus, yes? And so I'm very appreciative of Mark's gospel. Because Mark writes a gospel that I think we can relate with our hectic pace of life. There is a word in the New Testament, euthaos. Euthaos, that's for all my Greek scholars. Euthaos, it shows up 59 times in the New Testament, and the word means immediately, right away, at once. And sometimes it kind of notes continual action, that it started immediately and it just kept going. Euthaos, 59 times in the New Testament, 41 of the 59, two-thirds in the Gospel of Mark, which is the shortest gospel, by the way. 11 times in the first chapter alone. So if you read Mark chapter 1 in the ESV, English Standard Version, they just translate it immediately, over and over again. It's and immediately Jesus did this, and immediately Jesus did this, and immediately Jesus did this. And what you end up with is this really fast-paced gospel, and you get the sense that Jesus is just running from one place to the next, and he's doing miracles, and then he's teaching, and then he's doing healings, and he's back in the synagogue, and then he's crossing the lake, and then he's walking on water, and he's multiplying loaves, and immediately, and it feels like a rush. Feels a lot like my life. But as you read Mark's gospel, there's something else to hear. In the midst of this frantic pace of ministry, Jesus is doing something else. Remember, Mark chapter 1, it says immediately the Spirit drove him into the wilderness, but what does he do there? He's in the wilderness for 40 days, all by himself, alone. The devil shows up to tempt him, yes, but remember, he spends 40 days, it's him and his Father. And then verse 35, at the very moment where this high-paced ministry seems to start, it says, "And rising very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place. And there he prayed." He found a way to go and get alone, just him and his Father. Verse 45 of chapter 1, "But he went out and began talking freely about it and to spread the news," talking about the gospel, "so that Jesus could no longer openly enter a town." Jesus got so popular, he couldn't enter a town without a mob forming. So what did he do? He was out in desolate places, and even there, people were coming to him from every quarter. Chapter 3, verse 7, "Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea, and a great crowd followed." He's trying to get away, and they keep following him. And verse 13, "And he went up on a mountainside and called to him those who he desired, and they came and became his disciples." In the other Gospels, it talks about him going alone and praying all night. Verse 20, "Then he went home, and a crowd gathered again, so that they could not even eat." It's very popular. He sends his disciples out to do ministry. They come back. And when the apostles returned to Jesus and told them all that they had done and taught, he said, "Come away by yourself to a desolate place and rest a while. For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat." So you read this gospel, and in the midst of the hecticness, you almost get the sense that Jesus is trying to dodge the crowds. Not for lack of love, but he knew what it took to sustain that level of relational capacity. I'd suggest to you this morning, Jesus had more relationship capacity than any of us in this room. And the way he was able to sustain that is by time alone with the Father. Solitude opened the door for the connections that Jesus had with the people who so desperately needed them. I don't know about you, but for the last year of my life, one of the ways I've been praying is that God would help me make sense of the times that we live in. And I've prayed about the division in our country, and I've thought about, as a Christian, as a Jesus follower, what is it that I'm supposed to do to become a solution to the problem and not a contributor to the problem? And can I tell you what I've landed on? As backwards as it sounds, I really think that we would actually serve our church, our community, our nation better if all of us said, "You know what? I'm going to allow that loneliness in my life as long as it takes, and it will take some time, and it won't be easy. I'm going to allow that loneliness to be converted into solitude. When I feel bored, when I feel restless, when the temptation is to pull out my phone and send out text messages shotgun style." Have you done this? You're feeling lonely or bored, and so you just blast them out there, 20 or 30. "Hey, what's going on?" You just put a bunch out to see what sticks because you want somebody to respond and you want to have that connection, that dopamine hit in your brain. When I find myself in that place, what I'm going to do is I'm going to unlearn the habits that I've learned. So that when I'm bored, when I feel lonely, when I'm feeling disconnected, instead of turning to distraction, my preferred method is YouTube. This is my confession. Instead of turning to distraction, I'm going to turn inward. I'm going to learn to hear boredom, loneliness, disconnection. I'm going to learn to hear it as a call from my inner self. As a call to turn not to others, not to distraction, but to silence and to God. And this will be very difficult. It will take great effort at first, but it will be a powerful step of faith to step into my loneliness and believe that God already has everything that my inner emptiness needs to be filled. A great act of faith, trusting that if my emptiness can be filled by Christ in me, then I'm able, I'm ready to show up in community, not needy, not grasping, but full. And I can take the Christ in me and share it with a lost and dying world. I think that is the first step in dealing with our times. As counterintuitive as that sounds, I really do believe that practically for each one of us, the solution to our political division might just be more time alone with Him.